Bubble Bursts was the giant headline on the Herald Sun newspaper on Saturday, and I just couldn't believe it. You might remember last week we had David Collier, the campaign manager for the home buyer strike, on the show discussing a little bit of torment on whether or not to call that the housing bubble had burst. Well, he did last Wednesday, and by the weekend, the Real Estate Institute of Victoria was releasing their quarterly house price indices. And yes, the Herald Sun said Melbourne home prices dropped $400 a week in 2-year record plunge. And so that was a big, big call. It was of great interest to see in the Fairfax papers in the Age that usually when the REIV releases their quarterly figures, around about page 7, maybe page 9, there's something in the general news section talking about this good thing of prices having increased. Wow, aren't we all lucky? Don't we all feel better? Our property prices have gone up. Well, now the tide has turned. Now that in the last quarter the median price dropped $16,000, guess where the REIV statistics were? Hidden away in the Domain, which is the real estate section of the Age, in about page 9. Might have even been further back in the Domain. So really hidden away was this fact that property prices are dropping. And as we've been discussing over the previous 18 months, property prices went up some 30-odd percent, and now they're starting to turn. So we implore you to go on strike, anyone considering to buy a house. Do not buy now. It is not the time. Sit back and wait and watch as all these properties that investors have held that perhaps a few people are foreclosing on, but really the figures haven't gone through the roof yet. So it strongly indicates, as we've been talking about here on the Renegade Economist for close to 4 years, that speculators have a large influence upon the housing market, and we need to do something about this. And it will be done on Tuesday, May the 10th. We're holding a Pop the Housing Party. That's right, Pop the Housing Party. Free champagne and caviar for anyone on strike, any home buyers on strike. Come on down to the Order of Melbourne in Swanson Street in the city between 7 to 9 p.m., where you'll see all sorts of wild and wacky things. This is a property seminar for the pissed off and locked out, where we'll be telling it as it is, what the real story is in the real estate market, and building up a groundswell of campaign ideas to stop the speculator welfare. That has to be the prime aim of anyone concerned about housing prices. We've got to come together. We've got to find some common ground to stop the speculative welfare. We see first homeowners grants. We see negative gearing, we see capital gains discounts, we see all sorts of impediments and all sorts of incentives given to the people who already own property. And this is the challenge of our times because, as so many of us will know and feel, the brute force of the hollowing out of the Australian economy, we're seeing it globally. Our manufacturing sectors have been desecrated. Our government policy is hamstrung by corporate rule. Our carbon tax debate here in Australia is being seriously curtailed by lobbyists who the door seems to just open up at will for. But if you're an NGO trying to get a meeting, it's just really hard to get in there. So we've got to just keep building up the numbers who are registering on the prosper.org.au website. We have on there a total abstainers pledge. There's also a auto letter. You can look up your local MP and send him a letter outlining all of these tax changes that need to be made quickly so we can avoid these boom bust recessions. 44 million people in America on food stamps. Just unbelievable. So let's think about one of the other big housing affordability issues that came up this week, and it was the release of the HIA RP Data Residential Land Report that showed the number of land sales in Australia has fallen sharply, reaching levels not seen in a decade. And in the 12 months to December 2010, the number of land sales had fallen by 40.4% due to severe unaffordability reducing demand, said Tim Lawless, the research director at RP Data. And guess what was rolled out by the Housing Institute of Australia? Their economist Matthew King was jumping up and down saying that this is a result of low land supply. The government needs to sprawl further. We need to push outwards. Don't worry about all the land we're holding inside the urban growth boundary. Let's keep sprawling. And what many, well, all commentators had missed was that it wasn't so much the supply of land that curtailed the sales, but it was the realisation that land prices were above and beyond what the market can bear. And so we have two classes of players involved in this stage of the housing market. One is the land banker, traditionally squatocracy type families, and the well-to-do, people who understand that we all need somewhere to live, and with the sort of record population levels we've had over the last decade or so, is more than likely going to be pressure to move outwards, especially when our land use laws are just so pathetic in terms of building upwards, in terms of encouraging infill. And so the land bankers have been saying, wow, prices have gone up 30-odd% in the last year or so. Let's try and jack them up even more. And the developers, who have teams of economists and planners and people who have had a long history in the housing game, have added up the figures and said, no, these prices are just too much. The land bankers are trying to hold the housing market to ransom, and we aren't going to play for it. So that really is the Mexican standoff going on. And as Fred Harrison has warned listeners on this show many times before, our leading UK author, make sure you check out fredharrison.com, I think the website is, that when land sales and land volumes drop at huge levels like this, this really is a lead indicator that we're heading headfirst into a recession. And that is what Wayne Swan is concerned about, our treasurer. He's talking about the rivers of gold from the mining industry drying up. And I wonder if that is code language due to the monstrous drops in the Chinese housing prices that have gone on in March. As I try and find these figures, biggest fall and biggest price decline in 5 years. And in Beijing, prices plunged in March by 34% and in Hangzhou by 26%. And the average selling price across all cities was down 7% month on month in March. So things are moving fastly in the world of global capitalism. And we're going to play a song and come back very, very soon with the one and only Steve Keen. Thank you. as we welcome to the show Steve Keen, Associate Professor at the University of Western Sydney and a globally famous economist. Many of you would have read his blog at debtdeflation.com. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, mate. We're glad to be here.
Excellent. So, to bubble or not to bubble, still the debate continues.
Yes, I've actually had somebody copy me a comment from a character somewhere up in the northern Queensland area saying how he can't understand the hysteria being stroken right now and the craziness and mad people's attitude that the house prices are going to fall. And it's wonderful to see people who've been saying there's no bubble forever currently finding themselves in the minority of commentators rather than dominating it.
Well, that is exactly the case, isn't it? Because for so long, the everyday person's been hit over the head with this media story that property prices only ever go up.
Mm-hmm. And now the ones who've been pushing that story forever are now whinging that they can't get heard anymore, and everybody's saying property prices are going to fall. Of course, what's really happening is that it's the classic case of the old Mackay comment about how people go mad collectively and come to their senses individually. The number of individuals who've done that has risen dramatically, and a large part of that is because people are looking around and actually seeing that house prices are probably falling as we speak across most of the country.
And one of the problems is that our level of analysis only goes back a few years, or a few days even, according to mainstream commentators. Your blog specialises in long-term thinking.
Yeah, the data exists, and this is the thing that annoys me about what I call Magoonomics, where people tell you that prices aren't high now because they were X value back in 1990 or 2000 in some cases, and how debt levels aren't too bad because they're comparable to what they were back at interest rates are high, half what they were back now compared to so many years ago, et cetera, et cetera. If you look back in the 1960s, you find house prices compared to incomes are about one-third of what they are now, and interest rates were lower than they are now. On which basis, of course, according to those people, house prices should have been higher, not lower. So it is ridiculous that people have been cherry-picking the data, when if you actually look at the entire tree, the data strongly confirms that we're in not only a bubble, but the biggest we've ever been and one of the biggest bubbles ever recorded in asset markets across the globe.
And so in 1992, the average mortgage for a first home buyer was $71,500. Now it's $274,000.
Yeah, a factor of five increase in income in the mortgage when incomes have gone up by far less than that. And that's the sort of thing you can take a look at. Again, I wish the data went back further than 1992 in terms of the scale of mortgage. But the ultimate comparison that I like to use takes house prices back to 1960, disposable income back to 1960, and that data is available from the RBA website. I think it's the CGO5 from memory. So you get disposable income for the entire country. You divide that by population for the entire country, and if a bit of legwork through the ABS data, you can find the number of houses across that period. So you can actually finally get a comparison of saying what was the disposable income per household back in 1916, therefore covering all the demographic changes that have happened since then. What were the house prices back then? Now, the question then is divide the disposable income per house, which is an average figure, into the median house and see how long would it take a household which earns the average income per house to buy the median household. And the answer back in 1960 in Sydney and Melbourne was 2 years or under 2 years total income for the household. It reached a peak of 8 in Sydney. It's fallen back to 6. Melbourne has reached also much the same level. So there's been a tripling in the cost compared to income since 1960. Of buying a house.
And everyone from Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens downwards has been denying this bubble by saying that, well, now we have women in the workforce, there are lower interest rates, lower inflation, all those sort of things.
Yeah, the trouble is that you can hold that case as long as you don't look too far back. And what annoys me is that people are supposed to have a role of being the custodians of responsibility in the in our economy aren't doing that long look back, which is quite a feasible thing to do. The data is available in places like the RBA and the ABS website. The only thing you have to dig a bit further for is to find records on house prices going back that far, because ABS data only goes back to 87, though even that's far enough to find some of the trends I'm talking about. And there, Nigel Stapleton's work corresponds pretty closely to the figures you find for the ABS back in 1986, so you can trust his extrapolation back to 1960, and it stares you in the face. That's been a tripling in the prices, and of course interest rates are higher now than they were in the 1960s.
And so much of this material you're talking about can be seen at debtdeflation.com. And there's been a series of posts, This Time Had Better Be Different, Part 1 and Part 2. And in Part 1, you're talking a lot about, firstly, I want to ask you, why do you think Glenn Stevens and all these other commentators have really ignored what is really one of the foundations of economic thinking, and that is to be seen as fiscally conservative?
I think the trouble they have is that they have a particular mental model of how the economy operates, and people don't see an economy. They see their model of the economy when they talk about it, and their model tells them right from the very first principles that you don't have to worry about the level of debt. And therefore, they've been ignoring the level of debt. And of course, if in fact that's wrong, and in fact in the real world debt matters, then at some point you get a massive disconnect between your model and reality. And having done that, you then get yourself like a situation where I've got to really feel very sorry for that poor bastard and the policeman in Brisbane who copped that particular call. When they got about 1,000 calls coming in with 8 people on the line. And in that panic situation, he, you know, says something abusive to the woman who rings up. You cover your backside. And that's what's happening here, effectively, having ignored the problem for this length of time, and without the excuse that that caller and that the help centre caller had in Brisbane for not knowing what was going on. You really have to say, well, we couldn't have seen it coming. How could it have happened? Et cetera. They continue ignoring this evidence. And therefore, they're caught in this terrible situation that if they've said there's no bubble and nothing to worry about in house prices, then they have to sort of deny reality until after it's become too damn obvious that reality rules. It's a strange situation there, and I feel sorry for them in many ways. But the trouble is they were given a responsibility, and because their model of how the economy operates was the wrong model, they haven't fulfilled the actual words, terms of those responsibilities. They've done what they think is responsible, but it hasn't been what the economy needs.
And much of your concern has been about the role of the first homeowner's grant, or the first home vendor's boost, as you've rebadged it. Explain to us the multiplier effect behind that and why you're so concerned about it.
Yeah, well, what actually happens is that I call it the first-time vendor's grant, because what actually happens is that it's given to a first-time buyer. The buyer then takes that deposit along to the bank, and the bank then levers that up by whatever the loan-to-valuation ratio is at the time. So if you go back to the 1980s when the ratio was down about the 70% level and the grant was about $3,000, you'd walk in with $3,000 and the bank would turn that into $10,000 of buying power. And a lot of that money, of course, gets transferred to the price you paid to the vendor. You might not have paid the whole 10 grand across, but you might have paid, say, $8,000. So in effect, it increased the amount of money you had to pay to buy the property. Now, of course, you fast forward to today when the banks give you 95% loan-to-valuation ratios and the amount of money given by the government is $7,000. Even conservatively, that means you turn the $7,000 grant into $100,000 of buying power. And, of course, you then hand it over to the vendor. And what the vendor's normally doing in this escalator we call the Australian housing market is selling their first property and buying a second one. So they then take that $100,000 of real cash to the bank and use that as part of their deposit, lever that up, and then bid up the price of the properties they're buying. So it has a double whammy, and that's why the government grant was something of the order of $4 to $5 billion was paid out by the grant across the period when it was doubled. But the actual increase in mortgage debt across that time period was roughly $100 billion. And that's really the leverage effect of the additional debt that people take on, which has now meant that Australia's debt level, the mortgage debt to GDP, is about 15% higher than the peak reached in America.
And that is the core issue, where this level of denialism comes in again, that the Australian banking system is safer than the USA. Where are some of the similarities between these two banking systems?
Well, one of the most obvious similarity is that they're having really financed speculative bubbles by the business sector back in the 80s, which gave us the 87 stock market boom and crash. They've since moved across to the household sector. And if you take a look at the real estate loans as a percentage of the total loans for both the American and the Australian system, you find that back from 1945 through to about 1975, real estate loans constituted about 25% of the loan portfolio of American banks. Then they started to rise from that period on and reached a level of about 30% in the mid-1980s, and then really rapidly accelerated in the end of the 80s bubble through to the early 90s to reach 42% of the loans of the American banking sector. And now then they dipped a bit during the recession they had, and then 2000 they took off and finally reached about 55 to 57% of the total loan portfolio of the banks. So the banks are lending to the household sector, which frankly they shouldn't be doing to anything like that scale. And the Australians say they're responsible. We take a look at the data for Australia, and back in 1990, real estate loans constituted about 34% of their housing loans versus 38% for the American banks. By 1994, we tied at about 42-43%. And by 1995, they were 50% of the loans in Australia versus only 40% in America. And we have to then, the actual bubble in America, in fact, began in about 1998, and only by 2004-2005 had the level of real estate loans in America caught up with the level in Australia. So, and then we had a dip in the level of Australian loans as a percentage of total loans by the banks leading up to the financial crisis. When the first-time vendor scheme came in, they jumped on the bandwagon just like the first-time owners did, and we now have the situation that the level of real estate loans as a percentage of total loans for the Australian banking sector is about 58%, and in America it's 53%. So if we're more responsible about our lending to the household sector, how can we lend more money to them more rapidly, we're more in debt for longer, and now have a higher level of debt than the Americans have?
And so much of the American bust has been blamed on credit default options and liar loans and subprime loans and all those sort of things. Well, what about the Australian banking industry? Different terms, but similar policies coming through.
Well, I think the real danger with the Australians is not that they did that sort of stuff so much. They did some of it, sure, and that was more the non-banks that did that. The real thing with the Australian banking sector is they're much more intelligent in how they got into the borrower's pockets, because the Americans really, because they had originate and distribute, they really didn't care whether people had the capacity to repay the loan. So they'd originate the loan, bundle it up into a CDO, sell that off to somebody else. When the whole thing fell over, somebody else carried the consequences. The Australian banks, by and large, carried the loans more on their own loan books, and since they absorb most of the non-bank lenders, it's become even more extreme than that. What the Australians did was they used the idea of the poverty line as the amount of money one should have left over after you had paid your mortgage. And that's just recently been exposed by, I've forgotten the actual merchant bank that did that work recently, to say that the level that they chose as a poverty level is actually lower than the Henderson level. So Australian banks are willing to lend you give you a mortgage for a house if that left you with a residual amount of money, which was sufficient to be below the Henderson poverty line.
Yeah, I think
that means that, in fact, to be in a house in Australia, you can be in poverty. Now, that doesn't apply in America.
I think that was Merrill Lynch, the group that did that, and macrobusiness.com.au is the website for that. So what about residential mortgage-backed securities? How do they play out?
They weren't as significant in the Australian situation as they were in the American, but what I find ironic is the Australian government, in this crazy belief that more competition will make things better in the finance market, is actually trying to revive the mortgage-backed securities market. I think you'd certainly hope that the lessons in America were that mortgage-backed securities and the whole originate and distribute model is not one we should try to emulate. But I think it plays a less important role than it did in America. But to me, it's ironic that the government's lesson from the financial crisis is they need to revive what caused it.
Well, it seems like that in America, the taxpayer bailed out the banks after the crash. But in Australia, the government recently investing $4 billion worth in these residential mortgage-backed securities. You know, we're trying to prevent this crash via such activities.
Yeah, I know, which is, you know, the argument they're making now is they're going to be more responsible about doing it now than the Americans were then. But I think what's more likely to happen is that the market has already reached its saturation level and you simply can't push these mortgages out there. So I think in a lot of ways it's likely to be a forlorn attempt. You're trying to blow up a bubble, reinflate a bubble after it's already burst. They certainly managed to do that with the first-time owner scheme, but that was so successful in driving up prices that they're not likely to get many takers of those mortgage-backed securities.
Steve, one of the recent developments I haven't had time to cover yet is covered bonds. Can you give us an outline of what they are and what the government's trying to do there?
Well, that again is another, I think, a very dangerous idea. At the moment, of course, depositors have, though it's not a formally acknowledged part of the system, if a bank folded, then depositors would be first in line for the money of the bank. A covered bond says that a particular set of mortgages are financed by a bond issued by the bank and sold to private investors, and that the bond holders will be paid out in the event of a failure by the bank prior to the depositors. Now, in practical terms, what that would mean, I think, is that the amount of money that the Australian government would need to provide to cover deposits if there was a default by a bank would be larger than otherwise, because they'd pay out these bondholders first. And again, I think this is just the wrong way to be remanaging our financial system. We should be trying to make it more based on what depositors need and less based on trying to cover people who are trying to make money out of bonds.
Steve, we've only got a minute or two left. What's your view that in the last week or so, both China and the USA have had their credit ratings downgraded?
Yeah, that's a strange one. The Americans are in no danger of defaulting on their bonds because they're issued in American dollars and they pay them back in American dollars. That's far more a problem for a country like Argentina experienced some decades ago, that they had bonds issued in American dollars and had to pay them out of their export revenue. So it's a silly thing in one case, and I think it's really, you should be saying that the S&P should be the one of being downgraded, not the American government. However, to me, this is the end game in many ways of the unfolding of the whole financial system post Bretton Woods, because it had the innate flaw that the Americans were made their own currency, the reserve currency, which is exactly what Keynes wanted to prevent. And what you've seen as a result is the Americans abusing that privilege and running, in sustained payments deficits and leading to the breakdown of the system. So this is a sign that breakdown is getting closer, though it could take another 1 or 1.5 decades before it fully plays out.
Steve, last call. What's your message to those home buyers on strike?
Well, I hope the strike works. I would actually say that I'd like to actually campaign as well to say we should limit the first-time owner scheme so it only applies to new properties rather than having it on existing properties, because, as we know, that only benefits the seller, not the buyer. So keep the strike going, but also campaign to redefine the first-time owner scheme, because you can be sure if the prices start to fall, the government will try to rescue the price level, and we need to prevent that happening.
Steve Keen, fantastic to have you on the show. Keep up the good work, and listeners, check out debtdeflation.com.
Thanks, Carl.
Good on you. And there we go. That's Steve Keen talking up the Australian housing misery that policymakers are keeping us within. We have The Boldness coming up very, very soon. Before I go, though, I've got to admit something, Finn. You'll probably laugh at this, but last week I made a major faux pas. I said the housing minister, Tanya Plibersek, had 14 investment properties. I was wrong. That was the story linking back to the New South Wales housing minister 3 years ago. I apologise deeply to Tanya, but I was very surprised to see that Nick Xenophon owns six investment properties. I thought the guy was perfect. I couldn't believe that. So, we've got to wake these politicians up. We've got to stop the speculative warfare. My name is Carl Fitzgerald. Check out the home buyer strike at prosper.org.au. And thanks very much for listening to us this week on The Renegade Economists.